This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a pleasure for me to have on the show Stuart Beagle, a law professor at UCLA who's the author of a new and urgent book, The Right to Be Out, Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity in America's Public Schools. Stuart Beagle, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Listen, right off the top, I just wanted to get your reaction to the Tyler Clementi horrible suicide, the guy at Rutgers who was taped having gay sex, and then it was streamed on the web, and he jumped off a bridge.
Yes, I actually had a piece in the Huffington Post recently, actually on National Coming Out Day, October 11th. I started with the Tyler Clementi tragedy. Obviously, we don't know all the facts, so there's a lot still left to be learned. But one thing that's clear is that the pattern of peer mistreatment that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender teens face is a major problem and still, unfortunately, not addressed to the extent it can be in educational institutions.
Well, I want to get to how those institutions should address this through the course of our conversation. This next half hour, give us some background as to how common it is for someone LGBT to commit suicide after this kind of bullying.
Well, what I try to document at length in the first half of my book is what we know from court records, what we know from research, and what we know from the memoirs of so many LGBT persons who've written about their experiences as young people. And that is that, you know, many gay and lesbian and transgender youth today are doing really well. They're supported by their family. They're supported by their educational institutions. They have great friends. They're doing really well, and things are getting better all the time for them. Others are doing really badly and feeling very alone, badly mistreated in school, not supported by their family. And then there are many somewhere in the middle. So they have good days, they have bad days. They could be going along just fine, and then something very rocky will happen. So in the end, what we see is that it's still the case that the suicide rate for LGBT teens is about 3 to 4 times higher than for their straight counterparts.
Mm. And that's a brutal statistic right there. Let's get down to the essence of it and what schools can do to make, to reduce the suicide risk first and foremost, but also to make schools an inclusive and safe place for everybody, for all the students, all the teachers, with everyone having, as you put it in this book, equal respect and equal dignity.
Well, the whole second half of the book attempts to take that on after identifying where the law is, because the law has come a long way in terms of recognizing a right to be out for young people. The first thing I address is school climate. That's pretty much the foundational chapter of the second part of the book. School climate, of course, is the mood, the energy level, the way people interact with each other, the school culture is another way of putting it. And unfortunately, too many schools today don't focus on school climate, or they focus on it only as an afterthought. There's such a pressure more than ever to increase test scores, and too often that tends to be the heart of what the principal is thinking about, it's such a tough job today to be a principal. But there are many schools, public and private, that consciously focus on school climate and even rate, and even principals in some districts are, as part of their performance, they are rated on their school climate.
So how do you improve school climate?
So a bottom line, the first thing to note is that it doesn't cost any money, given how tough the budgets are these days in school districts. It doesn't cost a penny extra. It's a mindset, first and foremost, where you're actually talking about it from day one, first faculty meeting. You're maybe setting up activities, lesson plans, school assemblies, talking with the kids from the get-go, and also setting examples with regard to the fact that every person on the school grounds is there working together, committed to equal respect and equal dignity, and making the school an upbeat, collaborative, and positive place to be and to work.
I mean, I would think that the schools would do it ideally for the best of reasons, but if for no other reason, to cover their backside, because the law is so clear on this at this point, and you do go through in the first part of the book, Stuart Beagle, all the changes in the law. You say the law has come a long way. You just said that. And in the book, you call it a clear and unequivocal transformation in the law about taking positive action here, proactive action to make sure that people are treated well. And there was this case that I actually had forgotten about, the Nabosny case, that kind of set the bar. Can you explain that case a little bit?
That was a horrific case, and it took facts such as those to enable this plaintiff to win. It was the first time ever that an LGBT student won a discrimination case against the school district. First time ever, and it didn't happen until 1996. And it was in Ashland, Wisconsin, relatively rural Wisconsin, and he was consistently, Jamie Nabosny, an openly gay teenager, consistently badly mistreated by his peers. Verbal harassment, physical beatings, a mock rape in science class while kids cheered and the teacher did nothing. Urinated upon, put into special ed for the wrong reasons, where the two students who were bullying him and mistreating him the most were also placed. And he had a nervous breakdown, attempted suicide. He had to be hospitalized. And when he and his parents reported all these incidents over and over again, he was blamed. They told him, this is what boys will be boys, and this is what will happen if because you are openly gay. Horrific facts. It's amazing that the school district even chose to defend their actions. But they chose to defend their actions, and they won in the lower court. But they were the victory was reversed by the Federal Court of Appeals in Wisconsin.
And the reversal was very strong and laid the groundwork for school districts to have these affirmative policies in place. Otherwise, they were going to leave themselves open to losing in case after case and court after court. So even if they're not doing it for the highest, most noble reasons, I would think that school districts would try to make sure that their liabilities are low. But
yes.
And you talked, Stuart Beagle. I'm talking with Stuart Beagle. He's the author of The Right to Be Out, Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity in America's Public Schools. You talk about or you situate the right to be out as both a First Amendment right and a 14th Amendment right. Do you want to briefly explain that?
Yes. The First Amendment and the 14th Amendment both apply in the public sector. So this is a public sector right, as a general rule, K-12 and higher ed, and in addition in public sector settings throughout the country for people of every age. The First Amendment gives you the right to express fundamental aspects of identity and personhood, and the 14th Amendment guarantees that you are treated equally as a result of that expression. Very few courts actually say what I just said exactly in that way. But as you see in part one of my book, I document many cases that reflect rulings at this intersection of the First and 14th Amendments.
Now, back to the schools itself, Stuart Beagle, you talked about the climate, making the climate a safe one and an inclusive one for all. But you go further than that, and some of it is general advice that doesn't necessarily relate, as that line doesn't really, in specifics, to LGBTs. But, you know, you can also have an anti-bullying curriculum,
right,
which is generalizable. But you talk about the need also to be very specific and to mention LGBTs and disseminate information about gays and lesbians and bisexual and transgender people. At what point, though, can you do that? Because I know you get, or teachers or school districts get hit by conservative parents with the claim that it's not age appropriate.
Yes, that's a gigantic issue. In fact, Mr. Palladino, who's a Republican candidate for governor in New York, just recently made a speech in Brooklyn where he stated that youth should not be brainwashed into thinking that homosexuality is acceptable, words to that effect. And it was an outrageous speech, and it was reported on, and it reflects thinking that unfortunately is still out there in communities. Not everybody feels that way, and needless to say, a growing percentage of the population recognizes that if there's a problem, you need to talk about it. You can't assume that problems will go away. They need to be talked about openly. So the position that, that's something that people can talk about at home and in their churches and in their communities, but in schools we just don't mention it. That's private, personal stuff. We just don't mention it. In the meantime, you have same-sex couples bringing their kids to school. You have young people wrestling with their sexuality. You have horrific bullying. You have runaways. You have suicides, and you have people getting badly hurt physically and mentally, and you have people being killed or killing themselves. It's just not something that can be swept under the carpet and not talked about.
I'm speaking with Stuart Beagle. He's the author of The Right to Be Out, Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity in America's Public Schools. He's a law professor at UCLA. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. You recommend in the schools that there be faculty liaisons too, and that there be groups that could meet. As long as the school is having other groups meet, there's that 14th Amendment right for LGBT liaison groups too. And this has happened more and more over the last 15, 20 years with groups like PFLAG and GLSEN. I know in the schools, especially at the high school level, is this happening in like 5 through 8 too, 5th grade through 8th grade?
Well, it tends to be gay-straight alliances, as an example, tend to be more prevalent at high school levels. There's no question that strategies such as implementing gay-straight alliances or safe zones is another strategy. And another strategy is to have wellness centers on campus or wellness centers in the community that work together with schools. In San Francisco, the Asian Pacific Islander community has set up an API wellness center that is one of the most effective I've seen anywhere, and they work really closely with the local schools to provide support on many levels for young people. And finally, suicide prevention hotlines and suicide prevention within the school. So those four things are LGBT-specific, but also are in the school climate context. The gay-straight alliances, the safe zones, the wellness centers and the suicide prevention hotlines.
Describe what a safe zone is.
So a safe zone, it seems less prevalent today, maybe because it's happening de facto in so many ways. But what happened about 10 years ago, or maybe even 15 years ago, is that school districts that approved such programs would enable faculty members at individual schools to designate their classroom and designate themselves, the teachers, as a place where LGBT students or students who are wrestling with whether they are LGBT can go and feel safe to talk openly about their circumstances and find support at the school. A very profound, very simple yet very profound strategy.
Speaking with Stuart Beagle, you also mentioned in your book, The Right to Be Out, that there are specific separate issues that LGBT people of color have to deal with. Do you want to talk briefly about that?
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. For some reason, there is among the many myths in this area is the myth that LGBT issues are white male issues and wealthy white male issues. In fact, a lot of people see it, but there's no evidence that there's any difference in the percentages of LGBT across any and all races and ethnicities and socioeconomic status groups. There are different cultural differences in terms of how all that plays out, but it's highly nuanced. The research shows that it is highly nuanced and definitely something that exists across all groups and all members of society. LGBT youth of color do face typically a more complex set of challenges because because of the multiple identities that so many of them have.
Stuart Beagle, you've got your last chapter here before the conclusion is also on the special difficulties that the T in LGBT people have to deal with, the transgender people. What are some of those special challenges?
Well, transgender is one of the most complicated areas of all, and there's great misunderstanding about them. It zeroes in on gender identity, and for many people, they think transgender is only about surgery. But in reality, there are many transgender people that don't have surgery or may have some surgeries and not others. There are many transgender people who see themselves as somewhere between male and female, not necessarily wanting to transition from male to female or female to male, but see themselves as situated somewhere in between. This is very complicated. And the way it plays out, in particular in the K-12 schools, is that you have students who are transitioning or may have transitioned or may have decided to express their gender identity openly, which might be, again, somewhere in between. And they end up presenting as maybe one gender or close to one gender, but they may be biologically a different gender. Even if they want surgery, they don't typically have it at such a young age. Also, many transgender persons use hormones typically prescribed as a healthcare prescription from doctors, and often hormones are not prescribed to younger people. Still in K-12, so they might be trying to get the hormones in other ways, and so you have you have those complexities: the presenting as one gender, perhaps, and being biologically another gender, plus trying to get hormones, and perhaps not getting them legally sometimes, and all that. You can imagine a young person in that situation and imagine the people around them not knowing what to do, because too often that's the case.
Right. So for the students who are ignorant or intolerant, this must be something that they all too often seize on as an occasion for bullying.
Oh, no question. In fact, research has shown that whether you're talking about bullying for gays and lesbians generally or transgender, the key often is gender nonconformity. So if you have a gay male, for example, who is very masculine and macho type A alpha male, and many gays are, they tend not to be bullied or not to be bullied in the same way as the more effeminate gay man or gay young man. And the same is true with women. The feminine lesbian, and there are many very feminine lesbians, tend to be less made fun of or bullied than the stereotypical butch tomboy lesbian.
I'm speaking with Stuart Beagle. He's the author of The Right to Be Out, Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity in America's Public Schools. I'm Matt Rothschild of The Progressive Magazine. This is Progressive Radio. One of the places, the most nettlesome places where this bullying and name-calling happens is in sports, in high school sports or in sports at any level. And you talk about that. Why do you think that is such an outpost of the most reactionary attitudes on this question?
Well, the sports is really complicated. I was talking about this at the National Education Association a few weeks ago when I presented a policy brief that I had co-authored with former state Senator Sheila Kuehl of California. And I mentioned initially that sports is typically overlooked in this context. But before I went further, I wanted to emphasize that sports can be a really valuable and positive aspect of the educational experience, and it is for so many people. So it isn't sports itself that's the problem. It's the sports culture that has evolved in our American society, and how it is, unfortunately, in so many instances, very homophobic and very transphobic.
Why do you think it is, though? I mean, you talk about, there's some nice passages in your book, The Right to Be Out, where you're talking on about an athlete who talks about his first coach who is making, you know, the most derogatory comments about people just using slurs for people who weren't performing well, and yet other than that, as they say, the athlete thought the coach was a good coach, and.
Yeah.
And it was tragic to read that account, but it is so common, I think, even to this day.
If you look at the men's team sports at the professional level, because so often what happens at the professional level and what kids see on TV impacts how they act themselves or how their coaches act. In the four men's professional team sports, baseball, football, basketball, and hockey, there has never been one player who has come out while he was still playing. And there are only a handful former players who have ever come out. You know that percentage-wise, no matter what, whose estimate you follow, whether it's the religious right, who say 2-3%, whether it's census, which says 4-6%, of course, not everybody identifies for the census. Scholars say 6-8% of the population is LGBT. Kinsey said 10%. No matter which percentage you follow, they're going to be gay men in the men's professional team sports, and yet not a one has come out. There are reasons for that.
And those reasons are?
I think one of the places you start is the interrelationship between the military and sports. So many coaches were in the military. So many athletic programs do follow more militaristic approaches. And of course, there's a time and a place for a more militaristic approach if you're fighting wars. But sports are supposed to be fun. Sports are supposed to build character. And instead, what often happens is you have this overemphasis on masculinity to the exception. I'm talking about in the men's team sports or the men's sports, masculinity as A, something that's essential, and B, as something that LGBTs don't have. And then you have the nefarious myths, which don't just occur in sports, of course, but in many other settings, that gays are hypersexualized predators who can't be trusted.
How does this differ in women's sports?
Well, women's sports is very different in many ways, because you have in women's sports, particularly in some women's sports, an assumption that many of the athletes are lesbian. So that gets into an entirely different dynamic that can get very complicated, and there are instances reported in the Chronicle of Higher Education where coaches recruiting top women athletes, you know, try to emphasize that, well, we don't have any lesbians in our program. And so you have that angle. Unfortunately, you have. There was a coach at an Eastern school a while ago who was disciplined for her highly homophobic comments and the way she treated the openly lesbian students on her team. So it's a different dynamic, but also really tough for the students.
Mm-hmm. Speaking with Stuart Beagle, he's the author of The Right to Be Out. We've talked about the problems that students face. We've got just a minute left, and I wanted to touch on teachers. Teachers who are out, teachers who have a right to be out. Just recently, Jim DeMint, the arch-conservative Republican, said that teachers who are gay or lesbian shouldn't be allowed to teach, which is the antediluvian view.
Yes, there are... members of our communities who think that openly LGBT persons should not be allowed to teach. At this point, they're a distinct minority. LGBT educators can, and in many cases do, play a highly positive role in helping to make schools safe and welcoming for all students, including LGBT. They are an incredibly valuable resource. But unfortunately, there are still too many school districts that pressure them to stay closeted.
Mm-hmm. One of the great things about your book, Stuart Beagle, is you demonstrate that a gay or lesbian teacher has an equal right to have a picture of his or her partner on this in their office or on their desk, as long as the heterosexual teacher has that right. And the foundation for that right you lay out beautifully in the first half of this book. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Stuart Beagle, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.